All right, we're in CLR world for a series of conversations with people, just like we did last year for CLR 4. Now we're at CLR 4.5, and we are with?
Dave Broman.
Okay.
I work on the diagnostics team of the CLR.
Okay.
And our charter is to help the production of diagnostic tools so that developers who work within Visual Studio or even outside of Visual Studio can have a good experience debugging, profiling, or any other kinds of diagnostics that they need to do.
Okay.
So what we do is we write APIs that help these tools peek inside the CLR so they can see what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And these APIs are used by Visual Studio, by their debugger and profiler, and there are a whole bunch of third-party tools, diagnostics tools, that make use of our APIs as well. So part of what we do is to support Visual Studio, and part of what we do is to support these other tools that make writing managed code so pleasurable and enjoyable.
Cool. Now, speaking of, you know, you said managed code,
mm-hmm.
your tools, are they managed code?
Usually not.
Yes. Aha. See?
Right.
Let's get down to brass tacks. That's fine. That's great, because you are enabling the things above. Because I was wondering how you could peek into the CLR and manage code.
Right. So the way this works is some tools are completely written in native code.
Great.
Some tools are a mixture, but it's pretty rare that you will find a tool that's 100% managed code that uses our APIs to peek into managed code. So we're sort of at the bottom of the stack doing all the dirty work so that the developers who consume our stuff don't have to do the dirty work. And that includes what debuggers have to do and what profilers have to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, you're working on a really interesting feature that's called Rejit. What is this?
Yeah, so Rejit is kind of an interesting feature in that a lot of what we do, like I said before, is really to support Visual Studio. Like they'll say, we want this new ability for the debugger to produce this kind of information. Please help us. Please give us an API that peeks into the CLR and gives it to us. Some of the time, though, we do features that Visual Studio is not going to consume yet, and maybe will at some point in the future. And this is one of those examples. This is maybe the most demanded, most frequently asked for feature by these tools vendors outside of Microsoft.
Hmm.
And so what they do is they write tools that do all sorts of things through instrumentation. So what they'll do is they'll look at the Microsoft Intermediate Language that the JIT will compile into native code, and they'll say, I want to add my own hooks into this so I can see what's going on and get notifications at certain points. And they do this through a process called aisle rewriting. So what happens is, just as we're about to JIT compile some IL, the tool will take that IL and it will add its hooks and then release it, and then the JIT compiler does its thing and compiles it down to native code. And they do this for all sorts of reasons. They do it to get to do fault injection, to monitor production applications, to get code coverage information, to get call tracing, all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things they constantly ask us all the time is, why do I have to do my instrumentation only once just before the code is JITted? Maybe I want to instrument afterward. Maybe I want to change the level of instrumentation I do as the lifetime goes on. Mm-hmm. And we said, yeah, that would be kind of nice.
Yes.
So the term rejit implies JITting again. So we've already JIT compiled code once,
mm-hmm.
and now the tool wants to come in and change the level of instrumentation. And for that to have any effect, we have to compile it again. We have mm-hmm. to take the new IL they provided and compile it again.
Interesting.
So the primary scenario we're going after in this release, in 4.5, is production monitoring tools. I'm trying to think, it might be good to like go on to the whiteboard
yes.
at this point.
And always. Please do. It was all just a way to get you up there, man.
Okay.
Okay. Perfect.
Okay, so I'm really good at drawing rectangles, and that's all you're going to see me draw.
Okay, that's
pretty
fine.
Much all I can draw. But so as I was saying before, let's say you have the IL that you, the developer, have created that will be then compiled into native code. That's where the JIT comes in. JIT then into native code. And all this happens inside one big managed process. So the CLR is sitting around in here doing its thing. And for the scenario we're going after, the production monitoring scenario, you also have this little monitor sitting inside. So monitor was created by perhaps another company, and their charter is to help operations diagnose problems when they occur in production. So for example, the layout of a data center, you might have your front-end web servers, and maybe they talk to a middle-tier server. Maybe that guy talks to a SQL server. Do something that's not a rectangle to show I have some range, although maybe I should have stuck with the rectangle. And anyway, inside all these guys is that little monitor who's running. And that monitor follows transactions as they start at the web server, go through the middle tier, and down into SQL. And they can provide this unified view to the operations manager that tells them, for this particular request, we spent about this much time here, this much time here, and this much time here. Mm-hmm. And it does that through this process of instrumenting code. So it will take the IL that sits on the web server, that sits in the middle tier, and SQL actually can do managed code as well, though the monitor typically does more native instrumentation on this end. But it'll take that, and it'll go ahead and say, well, before the JIT comes in, I'm going to get in here, me, the monitor, and I'm going to make my own version of the IL, which looks very similar, but I've added maybe a hook here and a hook here, so I know when that code starts and when it ends. And then I'm going to let the JIT compile that to native code. So that's how things work in CLR 4.0. Mm-hmm. And the problem with this is, let's say your server is running for a while, and maybe a few days, and everything's fine. But then all of a sudden there's a problem, something's slowing down, we don't know why it's slowing down. The amount of instrumentation that the tool has performed so far is sort of a good steady-state instrumentation that lets us know, okay, things are good, oh, things are bad. It lets you know between good and bad, but maybe doesn't let you hone in on where here is the actual problem, where's the bottleneck. So when the problem occurs, what the tool would like to be able to do is to say, okay, all this other native code that's been compiled, I want to recompile that with my own instrumentation that goes a little further down, a little deeper, so we can hone in on the problem. And the way they do that today is they tear down the whole process, restart, and then at the beginning they say, okay, now I'm going to do a little bit more instrumentation. This IL, this IL, this IL will all get instrumented so we can make more instrumented versions of the native code. And what has happened? We've destroyed the reproducing case. The problem on the in the data center has disappeared because we restarted the whole application. And so now we have to run with this high level of instrumentation that slows everything down, hoping that in a day or two we'll be able to reproduce the problem, but possibly not. Mm. So it's a long way before we actually get to the feature, but the feature is, let's not do that. Let's not tear down the whole process. Let's just say, okay, we had this IL before. Let's instrument it without restarting and then have the JIT kick in later. Even though it's already compiled it, just have the JIT compile it again. So I can show you a little example mm-hmm. that my program manager, Abhishek Mandal, and I worked up that shows a website and shows this little monitor tool mm-hmm. and a log that it generates to give you an idea of how this might be able to be used to hone in on a problem.
That's cool. Now, before we get to the demo, I would like to ask, I mean, clearly this would be instrumental in the cloud.
Sure,
obviously, right?
Yeah.
And I guess one of the questions I would have, when you re-JIT, so let's say, for example, it's an ASP.NET application we're talking about here, right? And obviously, when you tear down an application and re-JIT, it slows things down. You lose all your, of course, you could back up, I guess, your session state and your cache and all that junk. But with re-JITing, tell me how that's not the case, right? So for an ASP.NET app where, let's say this happens, right? A function gets modified to add some specific monitoring to. So in this function or method in C#, I'm, add some instrumentation before start because for some reason this function takes too long to compute under certain circumstances and we don't know what they are, so I add some monitoring to it. Mm-hmm. I re-JIT, but it doesn't restart my application.
Right.
That's the key.
That's what this feature
roll.
Is all about.
Rock
so the memory that the application has been using, that ASP.NET has been using, is untouched. It's
cool.
Still there. The whole state is still there. whatever craziness caused this problem to occur is still there. So now you can dig deeper and view into that craziness to see where the problem lies.
Beautiful. I think everyone understands that. If I understand, they understand. That's channel 9, man.
All right,
I'm a proxy to them. Okay, let's see what's going on here.
Okay. Watch me turn on my monitor first. You need to log in.
Perfect.
All right, so what you see here is a website, an example of a website that you might want to attach a monitoring tool to. And what the website does is it has different categories of music, and you can click on the albums and stuff. And so while that's going on, I have a monitoring tool running in the background. And what that tool does is it generates a call graph to some degree of resolution. So I'll refresh this so you see the things I just did. So you see these are the requests that I just made. And there isn't a very high level of instrumentation. There's process request notification. We know when it gets entered and exited. Calls itself recursively. But that's about it. So it's pretty lightweight, and things don't slow down too much. But it doesn't give us a ton of information.
Okay.
So what happens, so you probably notice things are kind of zippy pretty quick. But if I go ahead and add something to the cart, and it sort of spins and spins, I'm like, what's going on? And so I take a look at my instrumentation, and we go down, we have this, blah, blah, blah. And then when we get to the bottom, it says, yeah, this guy took a little longer. So it's a really smart monitoring tool, and it knows if something took 1,485 milliseconds, there's a problem. Mm. But it doesn't tell me what the problem is. It just says, yes, that same function that gets called all the time was a little slower. So what I'd like to be able to do is, now that I have this reproducing case available to me, I want to dig deeper and instrument some more. So that's at the cost of slowing things down a bit, but my benefit is that I get to find out where the problem lies. So I will pop up my highly advanced user interface to the monitoring, which if you actually go ahead and pay $20,000 for one of these tools, I think it'll look a lot nicer than this. But I'm going to hit enter, and I don't want you to blink. Because that was it. That was reach-it in action right there. We just sent a signal to the web server, to the app pool, and told it, please reach-it a bunch more methods with a bunch more instrumentation so we can hone in on the problem.
Nice.
So now I will go ahead and click around some more. Maybe go to Temple of the Dog, add him to my cart. It takes a little longer. And now let's look at our call graph. Now, as I scroll down, you're going to see a whole bunch more things got instrumented. So it's not just process request notification anymore. We have all these accessors and constructors and everything, and all we have a bunch more information because we were able to rejit those functions that were already jitted and add more levels of instrumentation.
Excellent.
And now it's able to dig deeper and find out which function on the inside is taking so long. And I see that I, as the operations manager, can now go to my product team and say, what is this do something spectacular function? Why is that taking so long? And then, so now if I'm on the product team, I'll say, oh, do something spectacular. I don't know if you can see this text.
Yep. But
he's pretty much just sleeping for a second. Is that a problem? And the operations manager says, yeah, that's kind of a problem. So this is a very simplified view of a problem that could occur. Typically, it's never this easy to diagnose, but what this does allow you to do is narrow the problem down, find where the problem lies, if nothing more, on which hardware, which part of your multi-tiered architecture, or possibly even what class or what set of functions might be responsible. And then the operations manager has a lot more information to go back to the product team with to say, here's the problem, can you fix it? Otherwise, if all they see is process notification request, slows down, that's no information at all.
Absolutely.
And I did not have to restart.
Beautiful. That's really, really, really nice. And to be honest, I mean, you think about, like, for example, where this video is streaming from right now, Channel 9 is an Azure application, right? We're running in the cloud fully. Right. There is no operations manager. Well, there is. His name is Duncan. And the rest of the are dev geniuses. And they are the ones that have to do all of this, and they have a lot of monitoring that they've built themselves. So this is actually something I think would be really useful for highly trafficked websites that you always want to be up. And sometimes when something slows down, rather than going, oh, I'm just going to reset the application because we can't figure out what it is based on the data that we have from our profiling tools, we'll just rejit.
Yeah.
Now, of course, that means they're going to have to go to 4.5. We just got to 4 recently. Mm-hmm. But rock and roll, man.
Yeah.
very cool feature. Let's talk a little bit about the implementation details.
Oh, sure.
So, in some sense, you had mentioned to me off camera that you're not on the JIT team.
Right. So okay. I'm on the diagnostics team, and our goal is to make diagnostics tools better and easier to write.
Understood.
And the JIT itself is almost like a black box. So if I erase this, mm-hmm. look at the way the CLR is architected. So now this isn't a process so much as more an architecture diagram, mm-hmm. the CLR. So we have this JIT guy, and the inputs to the JIT are very, very specific and well-defined. Like, he wants some IL and some other things. I'm not an expert on
that. That's fine. Don't worry about it.
But so he'll take some IL, and out will come some native code. And the read-JIT feature does not sit inside this box. Mm. It sort of sits out here. Read-JIT is sort of out here.
Okay.
The JIT communicates with the rest of the CLR through a very well-defined interface here. And so inside this interface, some of the read-JIT functionality lives. But I would say most of read-JIT is really just completely separate and out here. What it's doing is it's doing some bookkeeping. It's allowing... So we have our profiler, who actually sits in the same process, profiler, monitor, whatever you like. And he's interacting with this read-JIT feature here. And he's telling it, okay, I want method A to be read-JITted. And when you read-JIT it, I want this new IL. I want these new flags, compilation flags. And probably a few other variables.
Sure.
And what we do is we say, okay, that function's already been JITted. What I'm going to do is wait for the next time that function gets called. And when it does, I'm going to like trigger a little stumbling block that I put over the code so that this part gets activated and says, okay, a thread has tried to re-enter that function that we've been told to re-JIT. I'm going to go ahead and, through this interface, ask the JIT to JIT it again, ask the compiler to recompile it. Mm. And this time I'm going to pass in this new IL and the new compilation flags that the profiler gave me on this second call to the JIT compiler.
Okay.
And then at any time later, the profiler says, okay, I've done that level of instrumentation. I found out what I want to do. My user is asking me to revert. So there's another command that it can send here called revert. And when that happens, we go ahead and just revert back to the originally JITted native code.
Excellent. Now, the question I would ask, and you sort of already answered this, but I want to ask it in a slightly different way. In the case of a, say, for example, a web service or ASP.NET app or whatever, if the application is, like, computing a request and this is asked to happen, what happens?
We don't try to get too sneaky. So
okay, cool.
Those of you familiar with edit and continue, that is one sneaky feature. So with edit and continue, it's kind of a similar idea. So you're in the debugger, here's your source code, you go ahead and edit it while it's running, and what we'll do is we recompile, much like read-JIT does, but we'll even do a hot map. So let's say your IP address was pointed here, and we recompile it to this other code. You're inside the middle of the function, we have a hot map of that IP. We'll forcibly move the IP into the new copy and try to figure out where within this new copy of code you should be relative to where you were before. And all of the local variables and all the parameters have to be at known locations on the stack, and we move them. It's a very complicated process. All that stuff is not needed for the scenarios we're going after with read-JIT. You don't have to really hot map your IP address from one to the other. In fact, that might really complicate things. It might produce unexpected behavior.
Ooh.
So what we do is we say, I'll try a different diagram here.
Okay.
Let's say you have a bunch of threads executing, as you always will on the web server, and they're all executing inside foo. Maybe we have three threads in foo. And along comes the profiler, and the profiler says, let's read-JIT foo. What happens is these threads that are inside foo stay there. They don't move. They stay in the old copy of foo. After they return out of foo and call it again, then they will be redirected to foo version 2. Mm. And so only on the next call do they end up in that new version of foo. So you're asking, what if the web server was in the middle of doing some kind of processing? Mm-hmm. It keeps doing exactly what it was doing. It doesn't get interrupted.
Great.
But the next time, it'll go to the new version.
Okay, that's awesome. And it's sort of rejitting in the background.
Yes.
From the perspective of this currently executing process.
Yeah, it's basically a thread the profiler created,
yeah.
A separate thread. He's the guy who's going to, well, to be precise, he's the thread that makes the request.
Okay.
The thread that does the jitting is the thread that makes the call the first time. So mm-hmm. that's actually how the CLR does everything. Everything is lazy. We don't do anything until we absolutely have to do it. Mm. Jitting is an example. We don't jit anything until the thread makes the call into the function and says, oh, I guess I need to compile it now, and so I compile it now. So the way rejit works is very similar. It says, all right, I'll set up the request to rejit it for later, and then the winner, the first thread to call into it the second time,
mm-hmm.
trips over what we call the pre-stub, and then we go ahead and jit it again with the new IL.
Excellent, man. And the again, just to be clear, the you know, in your world, you're implementing rejit in what language?
C++.
Rock and roll, brother. Now, that makes sense because, of course, the CLR is written in C++, and, of course, the jitter is written in C++. And I just want to bring that up because it's actually kind of a cool story, right? The power and performance comes from what normally you'd expect it to come from. All of us who get to deal in the much higher level experience, thank you for that.
Basically, we write C++ so you don't have to.
Well, yeah, understood, but let me ask you this, though. I mean, in some sense, C++ is evolving nicely. Are you taking advantage of any of the new features?
Well, we keep the CLR engine unmanaged. So there are some features added to C++ that make it a managed language, like you can deal with managed references directly from C++.
Mm.
We don't do that. We don't do that inside the engine. In fact, we keep things pretty simple.
Okay.
For example, we use templates, but we don't use them like crazy.
Okay. Do you use the STL?
No.
Do you use standard string, or so you use your own custom?
Yeah.
Okay. C string and stuff like that. W string, or don't say W char star.
We use our own stuff.
Fair enough. So that's great. Without getting into IP, I'm actually personally very interested in this aspect of it. I've never really done an interview on, you know, the implementation details of the managed world, which of course is based on the native world.
Sure.
So, I don't know, I was just curious about that. And are you using anything like auto? Or are you using any of the C++ 11 features that have been shipping for a few years? Just because you don't need them, or they're too expensive, or you don't want to mess with the code base?
I'm not in on those decisions directly, so
Got
I can't
it.
Speak to them directly, but I can say that generally we have a philosophy of keeping it simple and predictable.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want things running at times that we don't expect them to run. So we want to make sure everything is very predictable. Obviously, we want to keep it fast, and the closer to the ground we are, the more we have control over that. But also, there are some artifacts in the code base that don't lend themselves well to certain kinds of class libraries that we might use. Can't really get into the details of those too much, but the simpler we keep it, the easier it is for some of these constructs to be usable by us. So sort of like homegrown stuff that that's probably all I can say about that.
That's fine. Well, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, that's actually kind of a large usage case of C++, and certainly one of its strengths is that you have all these different ways to essentially guarantee exactly what you're looking for. So in terms of the managed stuff, you were really talking about C++ CLI, or were you talking about the like smart pointers, where you're having sort of...
Oh, okay. So in terms of CLI, yes, we're not
Absolutely
using
not.
C++.
Yeah.
When it comes to smart pointers, we do have our own smart pointers. So throughout the code base, you're going to see a lot of smart destructors everywhere to prevent memory leaks. And if an exception happens to be thrown at some point, we make sure that we do our cleanup properly. But then again, you know, different parts of the CLR code base have evolved in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas in this place you'll see a lot of return statements and a lot of constructed objects on the stack, if you move over here to this part of the code base, you'll see a lot of like go to error and like set HR to this and go to error and nothing is thrown and there are no objects. And it's just a matter of a lot of people to begin with, and this person worked on this part, this person worked on this part, and then they've evolved in different ways.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, it's a virtual machine, so you can imagine even the CLR has sort of the
lowest levels of itself, right? Which you would be, you'd expect would be sort of in
C,
or even assembly.
And there is, yeah.
Of course. Yeah. So, anyway, enough of that. But it's a rabbit hole I love to go into because I think it's actually kind of a beautiful story. I mean, it's the machine, how it's constructed and what it's enabled. If you look at it, it's got native at the core, and then it branches out into this really high level, excellent language that is C sharp and VB and rock and roll. So this feature is awesome. Can we talk a little bit about how you see it evolving without promising?
Sure.
Why not?
It is worthwhile to mention there are a lot of limitations in 4.5 on how well Reachit can be used. So we did go after the scenario of production monitoring for two reasons. One reason is it's real, and people who write production monitoring tools have told us, please give us Reachit. But there are a lot of other scenarios that are real that could also benefit from Reachit that we did not go after. Mm. And so that leads me to the second reason of why we picked production monitoring, which is it's the easier scenario for us. There are a lot of limitations we can put in place that are perfectly fine for people who write production monitoring tools that may not be fine for people who write other kinds of diagnostic tools. So for example, I think a lot of people are going to ask, can I use attach? Attach is a feature that allows your profiler to attach to an existing running process, and the profiler was not there from the beginning. So you launch a process without a profiler, and then later you attach. Mm. And the answer is, can you do attach plus Reachit? And the answer is no, can't do that yet. That's an example of a limitation that was not a bad limitation for production monitoring tools because they don't use attach at all. They're always there from the beginning. They're actually part of the deployment. They're part of the testing process. They're part of what operations management has said, yes, it's okay for this to be on the server. So it's really, it's deployed as if it's part of the user's application.
Okay.
And so they don't need to use attach. They're there all the time. But there are other tools, like even code coverage tools. Mm-hmm. We've been told that it would be super if I could, like, bring my application to some steady state without doing any instrumentation, and then, you know, here I am, my window has finally popped up, it's all the windows, all the buttons have been drawn in the window. Now I would like to attach my code coverage tool, attach my profiling code coverage tool, and start hitting buttons and then seeing what happens, see what code gets called as a result. Sorry, cannot do that in 4.5.
Okay.
If your code coverage tool is there from the very beginning, that's okay. He can decide what level of code coverage to apply after the fact, but he has to load from the beginning. So this is an example of something that's an opportunity in the future for us to visit that and make that work a little better.
Absolutely.
Other people might ask about NGEND images and whether you can re-JIT something that it's not just been JITted but was pre-JITted, which is the old name of NGEND. So NGEND is a tool you run against denial assembly, it creates native code, and now you don't JIT at runtime, you just load that native code at runtime instead.
Yeah.
And so NGEND plus re-JIT is no. that's another great area that we would like to start thinking about in some future release, but can't do that in 4.5.
So the interesting thing there I would ask is, I mean, in some sense, as you said, regen is the same thing as rejit. It would be the same exact thing. NGEN is just jits before it leaves my development environment. Mm-hmm. And instead of sending up a blob of IL, I send up a blob of machine code.
Right.
That's already got everything I need that's targeting the hardware that obviously I assume that
right.
I told it to target.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So what's the complexity with taking a bag of machine code like NGEN and trying to figure out how to re-JIT it?
It's totally doable.
Okay.
So it's not like it's some big impossible problem.
Great.
But it does add complexity. And so that would have been time spent that might have jeopardized getting re-JIT done in the first place.
Mm.
Just as a flavor of some of the unusual things about NGEN is inside your NGEN image, so let's say this is a file on disk, you have native code, but that's not all you have. You also have a whole bunch of baked structures. These are structures that the CLR usually creates at runtime to manage things like methods and classes and all the other stuff.
Okay.
So we don't really have as much of an opportunity to mess with these things after they've been baked into this image and then loaded into memory. Another example is that this code has been compiled without the concept of REGIT ever entering into the process.
Sure.
And what that means is, in order for REGIT to be supported today, we have to know that we might possibly REGIT code in the future when we compile it the first time, even though we're not compiling with instrumented IL. We may do some things here and there slightly differently than we normally would do if we hadn't known that REGIT was a possibility. So NGen is run against an IL assembly with no assumption that REGIT could ever be used. And therefore, there are some methods that would not be suitable to be REGITed because certain padding was not in place in some of the smaller functions, for example.
Okay.
So those are some of the challenges with NGen that we would have to address should we allow REGIT on NGen images in the future.
Sure. Understandable.
And there's probably one other interesting limitation, which is memory reclamation. That happens when your app domain unloads. So if you JIT something, then re-JIT it, and the app domain unloads, you get the memory back. If you JIT something, re-JIT it, and revert, you don't reclaim the memory until the app domain unloads afterward. So some people might expect that if they do re-JIT, re-JIT foo, and then they revert foo, all the memory that we used for the re-JITed version, all the IL the profiler gave us, all of the native code we generated, after we revert, we don't need it anymore, and we can just free that up. We don't quite do that. You have to wait until the app domain gets unloaded, and then that gets freed up. And again, like everything else, it's not really that hard. It's not undoable, but it's more time.
Sure.
It's more risk. So to meet the schedule, we chose for this pattern to be what we implement. And then maybe at some point in the future, we could do more aggressive memory reclamation when things get reverted and we can verify that they're not in use on any of the stacks of any of the threads.
Sure. It makes sense. I mean, and again, this clearly is mostly useful in distributed, long-running environments like the cloud. And I use the distributed word just because it sounds cool, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
This is about what's going on in any number of servers where your application is going to be running in the cloud today. Mm-hmm. Azure being a canonical example of where
sure.
this would be really useful
yeah.
As some sort of way to. Now, as a developer, I would be able to listen for issues. For example, I might know that there's no way that this isn't going to be computed in 30 milliseconds, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
It gets out to say, and I have some sort of boundary where I'm like, okay, this is nuts. I've instrumented my own code that way. Is there a way for me to call out and say, re-JIT me, re-JIT us?
Now, that's an interesting question. So now we've taken the tool out of the equation, and it's really the developer who wants to say, this is the version of the function I have now,
mm-hmm.
and then when I hit some kind of condition later on by my own logic,
mm-hmm.
I want to change that version of the function to something else.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Okay, understood.
Cannot do that. That is an interesting scenario. There are probably other ways to get that done
behavior,
that
sure.
wouldn't require using a REGIT feature.
Mm-hmm.
But really the closest you can come to that is the developer writes his own profiler
mm-hmm.
that he's intimately aware of, that his mm-hmm. code is intimately aware of, that would send a signal to the profiler, and the profiler would send a signal back to the CLR. But we never recommend people do that sort of thing because, first of all, you can only have one profiler loaded in a process at once.
Sure.
And once the developer writes his own,
mm-hmm.
like what if you want to attach a memory profiler or a sampling profiler? You can't anymore because you've sort of used up that one slot.
Got it.
And the other issue is what if your profiler that you think is always there is not, and you're like sending signals to something and you're not getting an answer back?
Mm-hmm.
You have to write fairly robust code to be able to deal with that. It's just not a good, it's not a good model.
Sure.
It's better if within your own application you can do everything directly. So for example, you could unload the app domain programmatically
mm-hmm.
and then reload the app domain with a slightly different assembly that you've already cooked up with a different level of instrumentation. So if you really want to change that level of instrumentation from within the code itself,
mm-hmm.
that might be another way to go about it. You just sort of statically author two versions of things, mm-hmm. and when you want to switch from one to the other, you unload the SAP domain and then run things sure. in a different one.
But in the best case scenario, like you said, and especially in sort of the cloud scenario where you do have management tools running all the time, because you know your app could be running on anywhere, right? Mm-hmm. And you want to know exactly what's going on at a certain point in time. So we already have that monitoring. So this will be useful, I would argue and hope, in the Azure world at some point.
Yes.
Right? So, Rigid as a service. I'm just
right. So when it comes to Azure, there's a bit of a strain. So on the one hand, Microsoft gives you like this sort of hands-off thing. Like Microsoft manages everything in the cloud for you. You don't have to worry too much about administering things yourself or installing your own tools. But on the flip side, sometimes people like a certain amount of control. And so there's tension between Microsoft doing everything for you and you wanting to be able to do a little bit. So in order to use Rigid in the cloud in Azure, there's going to be the question of how much permission are you going to have in your own Azure application to install your own tools to work the way you want. Mm. And I'm not familiar enough with like the different levels of...
Well, sure, you can have, like, there's the admin role now, right, where you basically okay. get an instance of Windows right. Server 2003.
Perfect.
Do whatever you want.
So if you're in that role, and that's the role you want to be in, and you have full control, go for it. You can go ahead and buy these tools. They exist today. They don't use Rigid yet, because it doesn't exist yet.
Sure, but they will.
Right, they use instrumentation, for sure, mm-hmm. and then in the future they'll be able to use Rigid to dynamically change the level of instrumentation without restarting, and then, yeah, you can install those in your cloud application.
Cool. Well, hey, this has been great. Great way to kick off the CLR 4.5 tour.
All right, good.
And I call it that, of course, because anything that's happening inside this envelope of native code uh-huh. Is very interesting, and we're going to talk a lot about that.
Great.
Anyway, great to meet you, man.
Thank you.
Take care.